The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Today FM.
It all happens here.
Now, I'm delighted that we're joined for the Culture Club tonight by possibly the most cultured man I know. Going back to the time when he went to the same school I went to, the North Mon in Cork, I know him from when he was my English tutor in UCC, and I have to admit it's as far back as the 1980s, starting to make me feel a little bit old. He is a broadcaster, translator, scriptwriter. He has run things like the Cork Film Festival, but most of all, he is a poet, an essayist. Theo Dorgan, thank you very much,
Matt,
for joining us for the Culture Club.
You. The younger you're getting, to mind all these demurrals, you're looking fine.
Thank you very much. So yeah. Are you. So are you. Anyway, we've lots to get through. And as I said, you're the most cultured man I know. And you have come up with, we ask everyone for a first single, and you have come up with the most left field choice that there has been for a single for any of our guests on the Culture Club. Tell us about it.
Well, you see, the thing is, I never bought singles. I had to mind my pennies when I was young. I still do. And so I could never see the point of singles when you could, you know, save a little more and buy an album. But I do remember, and it only came back to me when your lovely researcher asked me, you know, sort of these questions. Private Eye magazine used to issue these flexi discs. They were little thin plastic. You could bend them in half, right? And they were tucked into the pages of the magazine. They were comedy. The likes of Dudley Moore, Peter Cook, Peter Sellers, that sort of thing. And I remember those as being, at the time, quite hilarious. There was one where, well, it was a police announcement, you know. Anybody who, three of our lads were involved in an accident last night. A pedestrian was run down and killed. Anybody who witnessed this accident had better shut up about it immediately, because we'll find where you live. You know, this class of thing. You see why it appealed to my adolescent self.
And this was before the era when suddenly newspapers back in the late 20th century used to give away albums or effectively CDs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This actually
they
was
were
happening
very early
like
in
many
the
field.
Yeah, this was early 70s.
Let's
and
hear
they were always satirical comedy, you know.
Let's hear. We actually have got from the archive of satirical recordings from the 1960s Private Eye.
I haven't heard one for 50 years. God.
Coming up for 4:47 and time for Conservation Corner. Here's Peter Thing.
Hello. Here in Britain, we're privileged to be hosts to the only surviving Duke of Edinburgh outside captivity. I'm standing here in Windsor Great Park now, and I can see over there in the distance the distinctive long neck, the long hands clasped behind the long back, as this extraordinary creature busies himself with his mate. Aha, now he's caught sight of an intruder on his territory. And there you have the alarm cry of the Duke protecting his brood from the invasion of privacy. It's very exciting. He's coming closer to me now, and I can see very clearly his angry blue eyes darting this way and that as he thunders through the undergrowth.
What the bloody hell do you think you're doing, you bloody little fool?
I'm sorry, sir. I'm doing this programme on conservation, yeah, you see.
Well, you bloody well get out of here!
You're all out of the barbed
wire! Couldn't imagine the Christian Brothers allowing you to play that for the class in the Mon, would they?
The Christian Brothers wouldn't have allowed me to play anything I wanted to play, I can assure you. Oh, dear.
Okay, let's move on, though, to musicians and albums, because you have gone for the same artist as favourite artist and favourite album. So let's start with the album. Your choice is?
Well, I've always had an enormous love for Bob Dylan. And, I mean, there's so many albums to choose from. But I've always really liked Blood on the Tracks. I think it's a transition for him. But also, I love the lyrics in all of those songs. I think they're most consistently highly achieved lyrics in Dylan's career, if you had to pick an album for the lyrics alone. But it's a very memorable album. And it also has, in Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, there's an entire novel in 8 minutes, 51 seconds. You know, he's a remarkably protean man. I was delighted when he got the Nobel. A couple of po-faced Irish poets going, hey, hey, sniff, 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 he's not a real poet. He's the pure Orphic, the lyric gift. Nobody in the 20th century has had such a lyric gift. And an educated gift. That man knows the song tradition back to the 14th century border ballads. I just think he's remarkable. And there are lovely tracks. Now, I really love Tangled Up in Blue, Simple Twist of Fate, or Shelter from the Storm. I have no idea what track you've picked, if any.
Idiot Wind.
Oh, well, I mean, Idiot Wind. That's the soundtrack in the back of my head every time I turn on the news and see a politician trying to explain the unexplainable, you know. That's the instrumental backing track I hear.
Let's hear Idiot Wind.
Someone's got it in for me. They're planting stories in the press. Whoever it is, I wish they cut it out quick. But when they will, I can only guess. They say I shot a man named Gray and took his wife to Italy. She inherited a million bucks, and when she died, it came to me. I can't help it if I'm lucky. People see me all the time, and they just can't remember how to act. Their minds are filled with big ideas, images, and distorted facts. Even you, yesterday, you had to ask me where it was at. I couldn't believe after all these years, you didn't know me any better than that.
Idiot Wind from Blood on the Tracks, a 1975 album, so that's well into Dylan's career.
It is, but look what it predicts. It predicts Twitter, it predicts trolling, it predicts the sort of, you know, mindless hate that people get from people who've never met them, will never meet them, haven't troubled themselves to inform themselves about them. Dylan was getting that as soon as, I mean, you remember me cried Judas in the Manchester Free Trade Hall when he went to Electric. There's always somebody who wants to own you. They think they know some. I'm sure, amazingly as it might be, there are probably people out there who loathe you, who would, you know, have your babies if they met you, but they've decided they hate you, you know?
Actually, for those who are not familiar with it, just tell us about this thing. There were people when Dylan went to Electric Guitar that they said they would never listen to him again, that they regarded this as a sellout of his folk traditions.
But you see, what they betrayed is they knew nothing about the folk tradition, because the folk tradition is protein. It's always changing. It's always metamorphosing. I mean, do you think the Provençal minstrels of the 13th century wouldn't have picked up Fender Strats if they had got a chance to? Of course they would. But what happens is people make a kind of a lifestyle election. They put somebody in a place and they freak out if they ever leave them. You know, like in Dublin footballing terms, I mean, if Martin Cluxton suddenly metamorphosed...
Stephen Cluxton, sorry.
There was a film called Martin Cluxton. I just got crossed wires and what's left in my brain. But if Cluxton metamorphosed into a wing forward, there'd be fellas all over Dublin going apoplectic. They'd be having heart attacks, and you know, because, you know, stay where you are, in your box, I can deal with that. That attitude is everywhere, you know.
If Bob Dylan's your favourite musical artist and we asked you to pick
he's
a
one
album,
of... You see, the thing is, it's very hard to say one, I know.
Is
you say one favourite album. I have
Yeah, but we
200.
Have only so much time.
I know. So I'm just saying, no disrespect to Joni, no disrespect to Van or anybody else, you know. I have to pick one.
Okay, well then, if there were other artists and other albums you wanted to pick, who else would you talk about?
Leonard. Leonard. I loved Leonard.
This is obviously Leonard Cohen.
Leonard Cohen, sorry. Yes. You see, this is a generation gap here, Matt. I'd have to try to help you across it. You're too young. But no, Leonard Cohen was a master. The extraordinary thing about Cohen started out as a poet. And the best poems he wrote were his song lyrics. You know, it's when he actually started writing to music, his writing went up a gear. His own early poems, they're all right, but they're quite unremarkable. The song lyrics, though. And this is the thing that people didn't understand when Dylan, say, got the Nobel. The lyric tradition switches back and forth between speaking and singing, between the word and singing. Writing is very, very young comparatively. But the oral tradition goes back to the dawn of time, sitting around the campfire telling stories. And Cohen is a storyteller. Dylan is a storyteller. And the music lifts it along into a different place. It reaches a different place in the psyche.
Have you ever tried putting your own poems to music?
It's been done. In fact, one of the things that's going on, Colm Machan Umra, who I think is our contemporary Sean O'Riordan, which is but has his own idiom and his own genius, he put a long poem of mine called Sappho's Daughter to music, and we performed it with Barry McGovern, and Alwyn Foray did the speaking parts. And now I've written another long poem, and he's in the process of setting it to music. It's a commission from Kilkenny Arts Festival, and it was to be premiered this month, next month, but of course that's not going to happen. So the current plan is we're going to make a film about it, and then next August 22, it'll be premiered live in Kilkenny, in the cathedral there in Kilkenny at the Arts Festival.
A film of the poem?
Yeah.
Explain how that works.
Well, you know, Amargine, everyone says Amargine was the first poet in Ireland. I am a stag of seven tines, I am a hawk at evening, I am a wave on the shore, blah, 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 blah. Amargine was blowing. Amargine landed in here on a Phoenician trading ship out of Galicia. And he landed in here. And tell me the two of the Danann didn't have a poet. Of course they had. So my wife, Paula Meehan, and myself, we were commissioned once to write a film script about Amargine. And we came up with this thing. And Paula said, well, look, you know, if he landed in, there was another poet here. And it was a woman poet. So we decided it's a woman poet. So this long poem now is a dialogue between Amargine, the incomer, and an unnamed Danu, Bon Prunsa of the Tuatha De Danann. And it's about that moment of transition where one culture is going to supplant another and the supplanted culture goes underground, but it surfaces again in time. You know, because this is where we get the idea of the she, is the supersession of the Tuatha De Danann by the Milesians. Right. So it's an interrogation of history, and it's sex and drugs and rock and roll, minus the drugs. And it's also, I hope, in its way, it's saying, look, would you ever relax about immigration? Everybody's an immigrant. Remember, I think the Bob song, Pity the Poor Immigrant. We all came out of somewhere. Every time I meet someone who talks to me about the pure Irish, I offer to pay for a DNA test. Not one person has taken me up on it yet. So, you know, it's supersession, it's integration, it's something new comes out of it. Look what happened to Cork hurling when Sean O'Gohalpin arrived. That marvellous phrase of Mihalo Mirahartik's, his mother from Fiji, his father from Fermanagh, neither a noted hurling stronghold.
Let's go to best ever gigs. You have a load of them here. Well, Leonard Cohen features as well.
Well, I saw Leonard's last album in Dublin. We did 8 encores and we sang along with 7 of them. And he was ecstatically happy that night. But I mean, I suppose I was 14 or 15 going to see Rory Gallagher in Cork City Hall. That was transcendence. That was the first time in my life I realised that, call it what you like, the power of art, the power of the imagination, you can lift outside yourself. It's almost indescribable. But it did set me thinking, and I remember a gig in 1975 in the Rainbow Theatre in Finsbury Park in London when Van was touring with the Caledonia Soul Orchestra. And it's the first time, last time I think anybody ever saw Van try to dance on stage, and you never saw anything funnier in your life. They're in white trousers, a pink hunting jacket, and he's doing these kind of spasmodic high kicks, one-legged high kicks, and they're off the beat. They just seem to be coming as nervous ticks, you know. But there was a woman, Terry Davis?
Terry Adams?
Terry Adams. She was the cellist with the Caledonia Soul Orchestra. Every eye in the house was riveted on her. She was an absolute ethereal, a celestial vision. Bloody good cello player as well. But it was almost astonishing how beautiful she was. And the women, as much as the men, were transfixed by her, you know. Because you could see this wave in the audience, but they'd suddenly jerk back to look at Van. And then they'd swing slowly around to look at Terry Davis. And then they'd jerk back to look at Van, you know.
Liz, my producer, has actually managed to find from that very Finsbury Park recording. This is the live double album. It's Too Late to Stop Now. It was recorded there. Van Morrison's Gloria.
Just about midnight, huh. Babe, I feel so good.
Does it make you sad, Theo Dorgan, to see such a talented man go so off the rails as he has in recent times?
Ashley Fadden was always off the rails.
And not to the extent of some of the stuff he's been doing recently.
Much in public. But when you talk to musicians, and I know an awful lot of musicians at this stage now, the stories about Van would make the hair stand up on the back. What he's been doing in public isn't the half of it. But of course it makes you sad. But, you know, there's a great injunction. Where did I hear it? I heard it at a gig once. Somebody was doing a long introduction to a song and someone shouts out, "Shut up and sing."
I thought that was about Bono, no?
Look, it could be. That's when he said, every time I clap my hand, a child dies in Africa. Someone said, stop clapping your hands. But shut up and sing would be good advice. But, you know, I don't want to marry Van. I don't want to live next door to Van. I don't want to be his best friend. I'm happy to listen to the songs, and the rest I just treat it as it's just something blowing by on the idiot wind, you know?
I think probably the first Ace Donna member to do the Culture Club for us is with us. Theo Dorgan, the poet and essayist, is with us. Of course, you were very involved for years as well, weren't you, with the Cork Film Festival?
That's right. Mick Hannigan and myself and Robbie MacDonald were sitting upstairs in the balcony of the Capitol Cinema in Cork when they announced in 1984 that was the end of the Cork Film Festival. We kind of looked at him and said, no, can't let that happen. So Mick and myself took it over. And there were 245 people there at the closing night that year. And the Opera House sits 1,000. The following year, we turned away 200 because we took it back to the city.
What do you mean by that?
Because what had happened to the Cork Film Festival had become so esoteric. Nobody was going to the films, but they were all going to the festival club afterwards in their dress suits and dicky bows and blah, blah, blah. It had become a social occasion for what passes for a middle class in Cork. And it had completely turned off the city. Our motto was from punks to pensioners. And we took it out and we went out deliberately and told everybody welcome. In fact, tongue in cheek, once on Cork Local Radio, I announced anybody turning up in a dress suit would be turned away. It was just being provocative. You know, I was young, forgive me. But and Mick went on to 20 glorious years of running that. I stayed with it for 4 years. I'd moved to Dublin then and I was headhunted to run Poetry Ireland. And that was another new challenge. Knock away the old boys club and let women poets in the door. But no, it was great fun. I mean, we went to all sorts of places. We had minuscule budgets. We'd have been making more on the dole, Mick and myself, than we were paying ourselves, because any penny that came in was to put films on the screen. So we could afford to go only to festivals if we were paid for. So Mick would go to Berlin and I'd go to Moscow. That's how I got to Moscow for the first time in 1985. That was a trip. It was the time of Gorbachev. You know, and I learned that the Russian national motto, whatever is on the passport, is "Uvidim," we'll see. You know, no matter what can we say, isn't this great? We'll see. It was a fantastic time, and we brought back some extraordinary films.
You've nominated one of those movies, I think, isn't it, as your all-time favorite? One called "Come and See."
Come and See. Now, when I say it's my favorite, I have to qualify that, Matt. It's probably the one film that's made the biggest impact on me in my life, but it's horrific. It's harrowing stuff. It's set in the battle between the SS and the Belarusian partisans in the Second World War. And I've never seen anything that brings home the sheer horror of war or the bestial depths that human beings can descend to than that film. It's unremitting and it's merciless, but it's an extraordinarily composed film. I got to meet the guy who made it, Yelim Klimov. He'd been banned under Stalin and he'd only just now surfaced under Gorbachev. In fact, when I met him, I love this. Picture this, right? Friday night in Moscow and you're on your way into a palace, into a party, because as guests of the festival, all these delegates, we're into a party in the Yudryevsky Palace in the Kremlin. And I'm thinking, Monday morning, I'm going to be walking down Patrick Street in Cork and someone's going to say, "Did you have an interest in that the weekend?" I said, "Yeah, I went to a party in the Kremlin with Bobby De Niro and Nastassja Kinski. What about yourself?" It was that level of unreality. But I met Klimov there and I was introduced to him by the distributor who told me, you know, this man is taking your film to Ireland. He was fascinated by Ireland. But he'd just been commissioned to make The Master and Margarita, Bulgakov's great novel, where the devil comes to Petersburg in the form of a cat. I remember asking him, I said, "How are you going to do the cat?" And he looks at me with a kind of a West Kerry look and he says, "No, with great difficulty." You know, that kind of sense of humour. There's a level of Russian humour and Irish humour that are absolutely out of the one box, you know.
But you have nominated another movie for us, which we will have a clip from. And this goes back to 1935, The Marx Brothers, A Night at the Opera.
Ah, that's the Marx Brothers are unparalleled. They're amazing.
But anyhow, we're all set now, aren't we?
Sure.
Now, just you put your name right down there, and then the deal is legal.
I forgot to tell you, I can't write.
No, that's all right. There's no ink in the pen anyhow. But listen, it's a contract, isn't it?
Oh, sure.
We've got a contract, no matter how small it is.
Hey, wait. What does this say here, this thing here?
Oh, that's the usual clause. That's in every contract. That just says,
if any of the parties participating in this contract are shown not to be in their right mind, the entire agreement is automatically nullified.
Well, I don't know.
It's all right. That's in every contract. That's what they call a sanity clause.
You can't fool me. There ain't no sanity clause.
I can never remember, Matt. I should have asked your researcher because obviously I'm well on the ball. My all-time favourite line from an American movie, Margaret Dumont and Groucho Marx are in a clinch and she says, closer, hold me closer. If I hold you any closer, I'll be behind you. And that was an ad lib on set.
Favourite play?
All Translations.
By Brian Friel. Why so?
Absolutely.
You're not the first person to have nominated.
Really, I'm not surprised. It is a masterpiece, and it's a masterpiece of 20th century theatre because it touches on something that almost all of the world has to deal with, which is what happens to your culture when a militarily more powerful and economically more powerful culture attempts to rip it out. Translations is set at a time when the British Ordnance Survey decided to map Ireland, but they put new names on all of the places. Now, when you take a place name in Ireland, the history of the place, the history of the people, the topography of the place, the shape of the mountains, the valleys, nearness to the sea, the rivers that run through it, they're all involved in the name. But when you take Cion Thoile, the head of the sea, and you make it Kinsale, you're doing something very, very bad. When you take Dublin, the black pool, which remembers the pool off the Liffey where the Dodder meets the Liffey, which is where the Vikings used to tie up their ships. It's a circular park in Dublin Castle now. And you make Dublin into Dublin. It means nothing. It's not a word. It's a sound put, graphically represented in letters. So Friel is superb on that. But he also, there's an undercurrent running through it. When the school teacher, the head schoolmaster and his friend are remembering setting off to join Humbert at Killala when the French landed in Ireland and they were attempting to march to Dublin. And he turns around and he says, but we turned around and came back. We were homesick for Athens. And I don't know precisely why that line is so poignant and so powerful. But in the head schools, they were teaching Greek and Latin in the head schools. And illiterate and innumerate soldiers were trampling all over them. A little later, and a very short time later, it became official government policy, British government policy, to extirpate the Irish language. You take a people's language, you take their memory, you take your memory, you're nothing. And it deals with all of those things, but in a very humane way. I remember once I was asked to give a lecture on it at the McGill Summer School, and Brian and Anne were in the audience, and I was explaining that there are no translations in translations. They're all homophones. The words that sound like the Irish that they're replacing. They're replacements, not translations. In fact, I said, I think the play should be called Homophonia. But Friel just cracked up. To this day, I regret that I didn't get a poster made up, with the four sisters or with the original translations and replace translations with Homophonia, He'd have hung it in the front hall. He was one of the wittiest and kindest of men. But that play has not a single crack in it. Not a single crack in it. Any actor will give their left arm to have a part in it,
I'm going to move to favourite books and authors because, as I mentioned at the outset, you were my English tutor in UCC. So we used to spend a lot of time discussing books. So tell us who you nominated as your favourite book and favourite author.
Well, I had to pick one. We've gone over all that. I won't bother with that again. I did actually ask myself on the way in here on the dart, how many books might I have read in my life? And we were in tens of thousands, right? But a book that made a profound impact on me, I decided to make it that. And it's Doris Lessing's The Four Gated City. It's the fifth book in her Children of Violence series, which traces a young woman called Martha Quest from Rhodesia, though she calls it Zambezia in the books, across into London in the 50s and the early 60s, where swinging London is starting up. You have the Aldermaston marches. The lessons of what the Soviets did to Hungary have still not been learned, and so people are still there are still people who think that communism is the hope of the future. It's a time of great transition. And the characters in the book are dealing with assaults on their sanity. It's like no other book, because it ends up with a kind of a space fiction, apocalyptic vision of the end of the world. Britain is devastated by bubonic plague, by nuclear strikes, all of which is entirely plausible in the time when she wrote the book. And inside it is the idea that at any given moment, there are people whose imaginations are struggling towards the next phase in our evolution as a kind, as a species. And that we've constructed a whole world to suppress that. We label these people delusional, mad, so on, in an excessively rationalistic world. And she makes the connection from this excessive emphasis on rationalism to the destruction of the world.
You got to know Doris Lessing because you interviewed her for a special event, I think it was for the...
Well, we interviewed her for... We had a books programme on RT until RTE decided, and I'm quoting what the commissioning editor said, that nobody in Ireland... Everyone knows nobody in Ireland reads books anymore. That's why the book series was dropped. But it was a weekly magazine series. I had four series. It ran for 4 years. But when we went to interview an author for the 10-minute slot in the program, we'd also do a longer interview and run that as a separate series of interviews. So you had Gore Vidal, Richard Ford, Edward Said, and Doris Lessing. And we went to interview Doris in London. And I don't know, do you know the way sometimes you just meet somebody and you click with them? You just do, you know. She's a very witty and very caustic woman. And we got a great interview from her.
Well, we have part of it. You talking to Doris Lessing, where she speaks about the art of novel writing.
Thank God there are no laws for how to write a novel. It is the writer who decides what to write. That gives us unbelievable freedom and, of course, responsibility. But it means that this is probably the freest of the art forms, also the most vital. You know, look how it keeps coming all over the world in different forms. And it is... It is one that I think is undervalued, this particular aspect of the novel. People don't notice it because we've got used to it. But when a novelist sits down to write, there's only one person who can say what this material should be. And if you're a writer, believe me, it's not any exterior prescription. I mean, unless you're that obsolete thing, a party member. You are thinking about how to present this material in a way that will make it come to life.
Doris Lessing there. You may not remember ever having said this to me, but I remember asking you once why it was that you wrote poetry and wrote essays rather than writing novels. And you said that Frank O'Connor had ruined it for you, that nobody else was going to come out of Cork writing novels after him.
I should have. There must have been drink involved in that. Or perhaps it was some kind of ecumenical matter. I do remember saying rather foolishly when I was a young man that I was too young to write novels. In fact, I have been writing novels. But it seems to be typical of my karma that I'm writing the kind of novels nobody wants to read. I'll tell you something. I have two non-fiction prose books about sailing. The first one, sailing a boat from Antigua to Kinsale, I had a really good agent, thanks to the late, great David Marcus, and he was convinced we were going to make money. God love him. But that book was turned on over and over again before Penguin Ireland took it, right? And the reason given was the same in every case. There isn't anything like that out there, so we can't afford the risk. The accountants had taken over the publishing houses, you know? But I suppose you write what comes to you. I don't believe in the willed book. You write what comes to you, and mostly what's come to me over the years has been poetry.
You mentioned Richard Ford. He did a culture club for us last
did
summer,
he?
Actually.
Did
He's
he?
Been a regular on this programme. He's an absolutely terrific guest to
he
have
didn't
on
like
the programme.
Me.
Did he not?
No, because when we went down to interview him in Kilkenny, Deirdre, the PA on the programme, had just bought her first motorcycle, 250 Honda. Now, a 250 Honda to Deirdre was a big bike, right? So he sees the helmet on the floor and he says, oh, I see your ride. What's your sickle? And she said, it's a Honda 250. That's not a motorbike. And I thought, the hell with you. disrespecting our pal here, you know. And he was going off. He knows he was going off to Wales hunting. I said, what are you hunting? He says, well, we're shooting rabbits. I says, you call shooting rabbits hunting? We did not get on.
Okay, but he's still a good friend of this program.
Well, I'll tell you, more than that, and, you know, one must always be fair, he has been extremely helpful to a whole generation of young writers coming through Trinity College. He's been scrupulously and out of his way helpful. I always allow Matt that people are living saints except when they meet me, and that just brings out their inner crank. You know, I'm sure he's sweetness on earth personified to everybody else, but I wasn't going to have him disrespecting your Deirdre.
Okay, we're very nearly out of time, so we're not going to have time to play another clip. Very briefly, do you watch much television?
Very little, because if I start, I don't stop. I've indulged myself. I started watching television when The Fugitive with David Janssen was in black and white. We used to get the number 3 bus across the Ballyfihan to watch it at my Uncle Christie's. But something I do tend to drift towards in the evenings is Escape to the Chateau.
What's that?
It's a thing about this curious couple, Dick and Angela, whom he addresses as Angel. They bought and they're doing up an old chateau in France. Now, they've branched out now. They're now advising other people on doing up. But there's something engaging about the two of them, you know. They're quite eccentric. Their attitude is, let's do this. And they're mad about each other. And they're, you know, they're not young people, you know. They're just engaging people, you know. And it's perfect mindless television, you know.
Theo Dorgan, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure
for the Culture Club here this evening on The Last Word at Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Weekdays from 4:30. Today.